Okay.
Well, guess what? We're all going to be on break as soon as the stay is over. Isn't that exciting? I'll be glad. I know it's well needed at this point. Before we begin, let me remind you that today is the last day to sign up for paper due dates and the viva voce. I think almost all of my students have done that, looking from the few remaining slots left. This is terribly helpful news if you haven't done it, because that means there aren't any slots left, but there are some. So if you haven't done that, be sure to do that before you head out on your break. And I look forward to reading these papers, look forward to meeting with you about them. I know that's going to be a really good time, and I hope it is for you as much as it will be, I know, for me. Any questions about any of that before we begin? All right. Well, let's pray together and then talk about Dutch Golden Age art. Oh, Lord and God, we thank you that because of your divine providence, because of your decrees, we are constantly being told by you what you are like and the things that you have made and in the way that you govern all those things. And we thank you for artists like these in Holland who are perceptive about that, who tunes their instrument to sing your praise in that particular way, to turn their attention toward the common things of life, like common looks and tones and fellowship and hearth and board with their beloved ones. And I pray that we would likewise turn our attention there, thanks to these very perceptive, very wise painters. Thank you for this, and pray that we would do this thanks to the work of your Spirit in us in Christ. In his name we pray. Amen. Okay. Now, when we last met, I was telling you about this international artistic style, which we now call the Baroque. And I pointed out that there's certainly a degree of regional variety among the painters we studied, with Velázquez in Spain versus Bernini in Rome. Yet, there's a surprising degree of homogeneity in European taste during the 17th century. It's a little unusual, really. And I use Rubens as an example of that, who was, of course, patronized by so many different magistrates in so many different countries. But you'll notice that I left out one very important and rising important country in our discussion, and that's Holland. Right? And if you know anything about the 17th century, you know that they produced quite a lot of painting, giving us a household name in the form of Rembrandt, who is so important that he has a toothpaste named after him, for goodness sake. So you know that he's got to be, I mean, he's not a Ninja Turtle, but he does have some toothpaste in him, so that's important. Why not cluster then the art made in Holland with the rest of the Baroque? Why not bring it all in as a unit? Well, I think it's because Dutch art in this 17th century is distinctive. It's decidedly different than the art that's being practiced around it, so much so that I want to give it its own proper place in the class, and then to do so, kind of explain why it's so very different. Of course, there's a lot of reasons why it might be different, why Holland might enjoy kind of a golden age in the 17th century. Probably most obviously, they're vying for their independence from Spain and actually very much succeeding at this. I mean, some of you may not know this, but Holland was, before that point, a protectorate of all places, Spain. Now, can you think about how odd that seems to our modern imaginations and sensibilities of people, groups, and their personality types to think of a Spaniard and a Dutchman in the same room together? It's already kind of almost comical. It looks like guys walked into a bar and kind of joke, But in fact, it was so. The Habsburgs controlled Holland. It was a protectorate of Spain up until the 80 Years' War, which raged from the late 16th and into the 17th century. It wasn't 80 years of constant warfare. It was a series of skirmishes during which Holland vied for its independence. But what this war did was give Holland a certain optimism that they would indeed be free, that practically they were free. And that's because Spain couldn't wage this war as she really wanted to and really needed to. She had troubles at sea in the open main, fighting off England and the Stuart monarchy, who was obviously in opposition to the Catholic Habsburgs. So there's good reason why Holland was optimistic. It has in it a kind of a similarity to America in the 18th century. You know, if you're familiar at all with that period, you know there's a kind of a buzz in this continent because we're gonna be free. We're gonna be our own people, right? There's a certainty to it. Well, it's like that in Holland. And the Dutch people then developed a kind of independent-mindedness. And it was a very free place economically, and in terms of legislature, you'll perhaps know that the Pilgrims, the American Pilgrims, first went to Holland, right? They went there first. It was closer, for goodness sakes. Then you go across the Atlantic, and you could just drop down the channel and go to Holland. And they went to Holland because it was the most religiously and politically and economically free country in Europe, right? It was a good place to be for them. But of course, that is not what I want to really stress this morning, because I don't think that really gets to the heart of the matter. Yes, of course, Holland was free. But the reason why the Pilgrims went there was not just because it was free, it was because it was reformed, because it had a certain kind of theological bent. Holland, is synonymous with reformed thought, with Calvinism. We can talk about Dutch Calvinism in two terms linked together by association. The Pilgrims went together because they went there because they too were reformed. They too shared this theology. And I think it's that more than anything else that affects the art that we're dealing with today, right? A theology that tells us and tells you that on your walk to class today, as you crossed over that snow-capped landscape and those little sparrows were landing in that tree nearby you, that that was not a random affair. That was not one of many things that could have happened thanks to the actions of some prime mover somewhere in the distance. That was actually something God did for you. In the same way that charismatics believe that God speaks to them, everywhere, all the time, Reformed people believe that too. They believe that he makes himself known generally in all his creatures and all their actions. And that the walk to class you had this morning would say, it says many of the painters we're dealing with today, the walk you had to class this morning was not some happenstance, but it was a whole series of beautiful things that God was laying in front of you systematically so that you could know about his character better, right? And what, of course, you did with that is any man's guess. I don't know. I don't know whether you're looking at your phone or whether you're looking around you or you're careful not to fall over as you're walking across the ice. I don't know. But I know what God did this morning. I know that because I, too, am a Calvinist. I share their position. And with that, this hard sense of providence, this sense of God's eternal decrees being permanent. All the things that he does are perpetually communicating to us. What this does for the artists is it drives them to attend to the things most near to them, right? There's no need necessarily to search ancient stories of mythology or some distant, remote past event to know about God, because you can see him in the faces of his image bearers all around you. You can see him everywhere he makes himself known. And so these artists turn their attention to everywhere he makes himself known. And I'm going to show you that through a number of works we're going to deal with today, starting with two artists whose techniques are almost diametrically opposed, but whose basic message is the same, Frans Hals and Jan Vermeer. You couldn't ask for two more different techniques. At the same time, I think you're going to see both of them say basically the same thing. And I want to begin... Once I get my slide up, I want to begin with Frans Hals. Now, this merry wine drinker here is the sort of painting that many people walk past in the gallery, and perhaps for good reason. It seems like a portrait of someone you don't know, right? It hasn't this kind of subject matter that commands our immediate attention and arrests us from walking on from one painting to the next. It isn't obviously about some story that we know. Washington is not crossing the Delaware. We do not find Socrates ready to drink the hemlock. We just find some guy standing there with a wine glass looking at us, right? So its subject matter isn't the sort of thing that commands our attention, but then that's just Hals' point. That's just what he wants to tell us, right? That this is the sort of thing you normally walk past. And if we were to overlook the contemporary dress, this is the thing that you normally walk past, right? Every day, right? Every day we walk past people with interesting faces that we don't look at. And Hall says, no, not this time. We're going to look, right? So here we have a man whose face is very much isolated for us. Notice his huge black hat is thrown sort of cockeyed in the back. And it works as a kind of frame for his head. It isolates his frame and exposes it in light. The hat is so very black that we lose all the detail to it, right? And that means that we focus our attention solely on this face. And what a face it is. It's ruddy, it's red-cheeked, perhaps a little flush from the wine he's drinking. There's a liquidity in his eyes, a kind of a wash across his eyeballs, which makes him seem fluid and lively. His mouth is practically open, he's speaking, we didn't even see his teeth. His mustachios are kind of going this way and that. Same thing with his hair, which is fairly untamed, kind of puffing out in both directions. Our eyes are drawn up to it through this collar, this beautiful lace collar. Of course, Holland was a great exporter of lace in the period, so this is contemporary fare. And he's wearing this fairly rich doublet with a nice chain hanging down with a nice gold coin on it. He's holding his wine glass, notice in a very unconventional sort of way. It's a fairly dangerous way to hold your glass, right? If my children were holding their glasses like that, I'd tell them to reconfigure. You're gonna spill it, honey. But notice that he does that because that gives us the sort of knobbly knuckles to compare to the little bubolus extensions on the stem of the glass. He raises his hand as if he's speaking to us, and other than that, the image is blank, right? The background's decidedly drab, right? Very unremarkable background. And in fact, the whole thing is thrown together with such a rapidity of execution that we don't realize because Halls has done it so well. I mean, take a moment and look at this hand over here, would you? You see this hand over here? He's done nothing to disguise his brushwork there. You can see practically every stroke, right? Not every stroke, but most of the strokes are exposed, right? He's actually achieved that connection of tissue between the thumb and the palm with one deliberate swap, sort of a bit of a brown. It's like that all over. I mean, stitches are laid out open, stitches over here laid out in tiny little brush marks. There's no real attempt to make them shaded. So why does it seem so good? It seems so good precisely because of that, because Halls enchants us. He makes us believe in his brushstrokes, believe that they're something that they're not. This actually extends all the way into the face. It would be tempting to think, he paints the face very close, but then the body really loose. But that's not so. Actually, you'll notice that there are aspects of the face which are very tight and very clear, but other aspects which are achieved with the same roughness and carelessness of brushwork. Notice the mustaches, right? The mustache just kind of thrown in there like he's sort of tossing pasta or something, right? Same thing with this little dab of reflected light on his chin. That's a single mark, right? He does this back and forth all over the surface. So what we have is a kind of constant toing and froing, tight and loose, tight and loose, and tight and loose. And that gives the surface of the painting. I'm not talking about the picture itself, but the actual surface, what you'd see if you were viewing the painting from the side like this, a kind of dynamism, a kind of sparkle, right? Which is analogous to the man's own personality, right? It actually connects to our subject matter. It makes the painting itself seem like what it's a painting of. It's one of the things that makes Halls such a great and painterly painter. So this is not, again, the kind of thing that we would normally notice. But Halls says, look again. And he probably pays this guy like however many guilder to come and sit in his studio for half an hour or 45 minutes while he paints them. Halls was extremely rapid in his execution. Yeah.
Either that or he kind of intoxicated
him
with wine.
Well, there's possibly a little bit of both, right? I mean, he's at the bar. He's like, that guy will do as good as any. I'll buy him another drink, and I'm sure he'll cooperate. He'll come along quietly. It's entirely possible, yeah. So he's painting with this kind of rapidity of execution. I've talked about that. But what that means is he can do this really quickly. I mean, once he was commissioned to do a large group portrait, and a lot of important men were in this portrait, and they said, how long is this going to be? Are we going to have to sit still for a long time? He said, no, it shouldn't take long at all. Maybe about an hour or so. You guys will be fine. Just come in. And he does. He paints very quickly. Now, he also paints very cheaply. Unlike Vermeer, who we're going to see in a minute, all the pigments needed to make this painting are all the cheapest pigments on offer in Hall's day. Mostly dirt, right? So the pigments I'm seeing, and I don't have an analysis chart of this painting. I'm not sure there is one, but it's pretty easy to guess what pigments he's using based on the way the colors read. The pigments I'm seeing are like French ochre, which is just a fancy word for yellow dirt. All right, there's Venetian red. That's a fancy term for red dirt, like clay. Then you've got bone black, right, which is what this is. I'm pretty sure, and that's basically just charcoal bones that have been crushed. and turn it into a powder, and that's your black. White is lead white. Lead is, of course, a fairly inexpensive element, right? It's easy to come by. So it's lead rust. And, you know, there may be a kind of green ochre in here to pull this off. Maybe not, but that's it. Some of his works involve maybe only four or five pigments, and that's it. So it's, but I think you get the point there too, right? It's not just because Hals is a cheapskate, although he kind of was, to be honest. I mean, Dutch people are very frugal, okay? So let's be honest with that, they tend to be. But it's not because he's a cheapskate, it's emphatic, right? That the simplest things in life, these everyday things, like dirt, pull this kind of thing off. And I think that's really exciting. So, questions about it? Thoughts about Hals's wine drinker here? Now, on the total other end of the technique spectrum is Jan Vermeer. Now, Vermeer is very slow. Hals painted many, many paintings, so many that we don't really have a good handle on how many he painted. He painted, you know, hundreds of paintings. Vermeer, we have about 32 or so that survive to this day. Not very many Vermeer. That means if you want to be a Vermeer scholar, you can learn every single Vermeer really well. It's kind of a nice, convenient artist to study in that regard. Everybody who studies Vermeer knows all the Vermeers. That's because Vermeer painted very slowly. His works were often very small. This one's only about that big. It's tiny, you know. Some of them even smaller still. Tiny openings into scenes of various sorts. He was very fastidious, very careful. Many of the passages in this image are achieved with the tiny pointed end of his brush, just tapping little dots of color. And in fact, as we'll see, he often alternates between the field color and white to give an object a texture. As you know, how light sits on a coarse object so that the high points are actually white, but the low points are the color of the object itself. Well, he does that in all sorts of places. You can see that over on the chair here, over here. Now, so he gives us a kind of very close faithfulness. And I want you to think about that. I mean, he's giving us a very, very close, faithful read of what? Madonna and Child, crucifixion scene, a picture of David and Goliath? No, 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 right? How about Venus and Mars? No. How about just like some guy sitting in a room with a Dutch girl, and actually it's just a normal room, right? Now, anybody who wants to pay that kind of faithful attention to something as commonplace as that is thinking about life in a very different way. But I think it's a way that's really helpful for us, right? You can see how he commands us to do the same. So let's see. It's not thrown together. I mean, he's actually very carefully organized this and all the images he deals with, needless to say, since it probably takes him months or perhaps even years to paint these paintings. This one has a decidedly muted palette, excepting one thing, right? Most of the image is a kind of set of browns and beiges and made of ochres and things like that. Of course, she has this very lively yellow. But you can understand that yellow is just a kind of bright extension of brown, right? It's a kind of sort of moving towards the primary from brown. She herself has this creams and beiges all over her face, so that she is the governess of the palette of the image, basically, right? She becomes the kind of central organizer of the color palette, color, same idea, of the image. But there is one exception to this basic sort of bland palette, and that is in our officer, right? This image is called The Officer and the Laughing Girl. Let's turn the light off so you can see this a little bit better. You see how his very bright red drape is different than the palette of the rest of the image. So too are the red flowers on the top of his huge, can I say, ostentatious sort of hat. Kind of this exaggerated flamboyant hat. And of course, he's wearing it inside when typically people don't, you know, I don't think normally wear hats of that sort indoors. Brimmed hats are meant for outdoors, right? So there's there he is, and he's got this elbow sticking out so far that it's into our space. So what's going on in this image? Well, obviously she thinks he's great, but do we? Notice that Vermeer gives us very little of him. He doesn't give us much more than just a sliver of his silhouette. His back is to us. He's the thing we have to climb over to get to the goodies that we want to look at, right? He's the obstacle in our way, right? And he's actually cornering us out with his elbow. Well, isn't it often like that, right? When you see
a young man of marriageable age talking to a young lady. She looks at him with great enthusiasm and thinks that everything he's doing is funny, or is she just pretending to think that? Sometimes the case. And then we see the whole thing from the outside and feel him to be actually embarrassing himself, right? How many of us have seen, well, surely, I mean, I'm in a room full of people in their late teens and early 20s. You see this practically every day on this campus, right? So you understand what this is like. And look how successful then Ramir is at showing us what this is like. Of course, the main point is not this little tete-a-tete of romance, if indeed it is romantic. The main point is this girl. And we find ourselves settled on her again and again. The light falls full flush on her face from the open window on the side. It reveals this beautiful Dutch physiognomy, this sort of round, soft features, beautiful lips that are kissed with a kind of white brush strokes to make them glisten, right? This sweet little rounded chin, all tied up with a wimple. Notice how modest Vermeer is in his treatment of femininity, right? Do a Google search for, well, actually don't, but so do a Google search for Vermeer nude figure. Don't do that because you can get any number of things if you do that, but there are none, right? He didn't paint the nude. He wasn't interested in it. And that's, I think it's self-telling, right? That he treats femininity with a kind of reverence, a kind of seriousness, while at the same time showing all the beauty of her form vis-a-vis, mediated through this beautiful drape, right? This beautiful yellow dress, which, by the way, I think Vermeer owned. He seems to use it again and again for several models. You imagine, like, he's got his own little dresses that he puts them in. But notice how her fingers are treated, right? These really delicate hands around that vessel. So sweet, so tender. So Vermeer, this is the way he works again and again. It shows us the glories of the commonplace, the glories of the everyday. Questions about the officer and the laughing girl here? Okay. Well, let's look at another Vermeer. The geographer. Of course, a very different subject matter. I mean, obviously, it's a single male figure as opposed to two figures. Mostly, our attention in the last one was on the female. This one's a single male figure. But compositionally, you'll notice it's very similar. I mean, in both images, we have to climb over something in the foreground to get to something in the midground, right? And remember, in the last one is the officer. In this case, it's this strange oriental drape that's really crowded far forward. That tends to be Vermeer's approach, right? We have to actually almost kind of jump over a hurdle to see the thing that he really wants us to see in a lot of his paintings. And indeed, that's what we do here. When we move into the room, we see a man at his intellectual labors, right? He's called the geographer, I think for good reason. We have a lot of little clues in the room to tell us his line of work. Perhaps most conspicuous is the globe, which is situated at the very top. Notice how the frame of the globe creates this sort of cross mark, this sort of Swiss cross. And that actually seems to be strangely analogous to the grid in the background created by the chest. Do you see how the chest also has that? So it's like his head is a globe. I mean, that's maybe putting it a little crass, but Vermeer understands that a geographer knows the shape of the world and the face of the world better than anybody else. He's actually not thinking about something precise, though, it seems. I mean, he's got his paper laid out. Notice how white that paper is. I mean, just gleaming because the light's falling in on it. And he's working away on this. He's got some other papers curled up. He's actually not sitting. Of course, if you ever come by my office when I'm in the white heat of trying to think through some paragraph that I'm writing, it'll look like this. I'm just like standing there, kind of not sitting down, thinking it through. This is what scholars are like all the time. I work with these guys, right? So I know them. We're an animated bunch. And he stands up. Notice the papers falling on the floor. I should also point out that my office floor is littered with this sort of stuff, so I understand what he's going through. He's this man of thought, right? And he's in the middle of working on something. But notice where he's looking. He's looking outside. He's looking out the window. Now, no geographer is ever going to look out a window and come to some conclusions about the shape of some country's borders, right? That doesn't work, right? Imagine he's drawing a map of Holland. Right, well, he's not going to be able to look out his window and solve that problem. And yet, isn't that what we do when we have intellectual problems? Right? We look off in the distance as if the solution is someplace out there, right? Have you ever worked on some like really difficult intellectual issue, some kind of hard proof in mathematics or something, and your eyes just kind of rise up and you're like,
We're looking up and as if the answer is in the sky.
But that's what he's doing, right?
He's a man of thought, and he's looking out onto the world, because it's the world itself that he's actually charting. It's the world out there that he's interested in. Yeah. So notice, technically, we meet the same sort of tricks. Lots of textures, lots of tiny little dots of white across the drape to make it seem light.
I want to draw your attention to a couple of really sweet moments over here on this table. So this table over here, otherwise unoccupied, it's got a straight edge on it, a little right angle, which geographers are going to use to chart certain things with. Notice how the edge is reflecting the light back onto the table through these little white marks along here, and how that's not one brush stroke, but a series of dashes. Same thing along the edge of the table itself. Look at that, right? Tiny little white marks along the way. White becomes for Vermeer a way of actually placing light in various tiny little fragments all over his works. Tiny little atoms of white make the work really sing. And you can see that up on the globe at the top there, on the legs of the globe. You can see that along the edge of this compass that he's holding. Obviously a geographer's tool. So many, many things show us how light behaves in the room. And again, Vermeer is interested in this everyday occurrence, and it is a fairly everyday occurrence in Holland, because Holland was a growing scientific community, and lots of people were studying the world and studying it very carefully. You notice there's a map in the background. I'm told it's a map of Holland. Vermeer used this map in a number of different paintings. Honestly, I can't make out how it's Holland, but I've never been able to see it. I'm sure it's there. Questions about it? Well, right. I mean, the man in the other picture was an officer. He's a scholar. But I would say that it's probably both wearing things that contemporary people of normal, sort of normal middle classes would wear. The officer in that back picture only looks like an officer through this hat. It's not really, he's not wearing marks of his class beyond that. Now, here he's obviously wearing a scholar's robe. This is what you wear, you know, when you remember the academy, you know. In the old days, I used to teach and things like that. Okay, well, you might then be unsurprised to find that it's Holland that gives us the most successful manifestations of still life in this period. Still life is a genre that has been around for a long time, and in fact, we can discover instances of it in the wall paintings in Pompeii and Rome in the first century. But it isn't terribly popular through the Middle Ages. It isn't terribly popular because of all sorts of reasons. But it finds popularity in this period.
Finally, paintings and food.
I know. I love still life, and I'll tell you why I love it. It's abstract art before abstract art was cool. It's a chance to think about beautiful objects as they arrange and relate to each other, and that's it. Again, the sort of thing that people are tempted to walk past in a gallery and not look at. Unless you're especially interested in realism, it's very hard to see why such a work would attract you, at least immediately. But a moment's reflection will show you why. It's because Peter Clays here has arranged some breakfast foods together to show us how they relate. And I think most conspicuously it's the citrus, right? Which is not a particularly common breakfast food in Holland. Actually, interestingly, smoked fish was, and actually blue cheese and wine. So those are the kind of things they would eat. Northern cultures tend to eat really strong foods for breakfast. A citrus, by contrast, is actually a southern delicacy. It's something that doesn't grow natively, has to be imported. And there it is. But notice how it's rendered to us. Not in a normal way. I mean, it's been peeled carefully, so the peel hangs down in this kind of slinky sort of way. And then the drape, which is really the tablecloth, has been pushed back like an artist's drape. I mean, it looks like, you know, like the way a toga would fall over the knee of some seated subject in some art studio. You know, I'm talking about some kind of figure. So there's a kind of forcefulness to that event there. And it reveals to us a sort of the circular shape of the citrus as that is articulated from that angle. But then we see it going the other direction in the slices. And that relates to the ovular shape of the plate on which it's situated. But also this oval has been tilted up like that, which is in opposition to that oval, right? This plate is ovular. Notice the bread here, the crust of bread has been sliced away on the one side, so we get that same kind of circular feature. And so we have a lot of relationships across this center line of circles that turn to ovals in different ways, right? Now let's stretch that further and see how that becomes the fish, right? Notice how the open mouth of this bowl here, I think this bowl is containing blue cheese, becomes even longer on the platter that the fish is on, and then the fish itself. And the fish has an interesting color, doesn't it? It's the same color as the bread. It's a smoked fish, a kipper, I guess we call it in English. I don't know how many of you are at kippers for breakfast. It's pretty, I have, it's wake you up in the morning, let me put it that way. So there's this smoked fish in the background that takes the same color as the bread does, which is a real surprise. But then maybe it's also sort of surprising to think about, you know, these grapes over here looking so much like the wine that they become, or the glass in which they're situated, because this glass has all these little nodules on it, just like the glass that Hall's wine drinker had as well. The vine itself comes into the painting. And that's something we don't expect at breakfast. I mean, we can grant almost, Peter Clay's, the fact that we have some nuts and some bread and a fish and some cheese at breakfast, maybe some salt, that makes sense, okay, so far so good. But I mean, come on, a cluster of grapes, and then the very, very vine that it comes off of. So there's this kind of transition into implausibility as we move in this direction. And that gives him, makes the image seem more fun. I mean, part of the pleasure of arranging a still life is keeping in place this tenuous balance between something that is seems sort of natural and something that is obviously composed. This is something you understand if you ever try to make one of these, but if you ever take an art class where you're made to arrange a still life, it's very hard. And I paint still lifes probably 3 or 4 times a year. And when I do, I probably spend an equal amount of time arranging the still life and painting it. Probably takes me about as much time to put the thing together as it does actually paint it. Because the putting it together is what makes the hard, is the hard work. And the painting is less consequential. And so here what we have is kind of low slung diagonal, kind of arcs across the image, and it moves from things that we just do not expect to see at breakfast to things that are just about as commonplace as breakfast as they can be, with kind of intermediary interesting things along the way. And I think that works out well. Of course, it's very subdued. I mean, the lighting's very dim. You know, it's just breakfast, right? It's just dawn, there's just not that much light. The background is kind of just this sort of olive drab. But I think for all that, it's very, very inviting, right? There's almost a smell to it, right? You can just imagine. Questions about it? Now, what has Peter Clay's taught us? I think what he's taught us is, maybe very simply put, when you go to the cafeteria today, if you get an apple, look at it before you bite, right? Think about what it looks like. Anybody who's ever been kind of seized up by the opalescence of the skin of a Macintosh apple, right, understands what Clay's is about. He understands what's drawing him here. Right, and that's a pleasure that's available to you every hour of the day, every moment of the day. And that's what these Dutch painters are emphasizing again and again. It's like, let's not live with our eyes closed. Let's live with them wide open. Questions? Okay. All of these people, I think, are fairly typical of the Dutch Golden Age. The figure I'm about to introduce to you is most certainly not. Rembrandt van Rijn is by far and away the most important, internationally important figure from the Dutch Golden Age. But I think that's because he was both more comprehensive in his treatment of so many different subject matters, more prolific in that he painted so many different things. He also did a lot of etchings and drawings, and more participant in the larger Baroque movement. At a certain point, things by Rembrandt look like we could meet them in Velázquez, or maybe even Rubens at times. Rembrandt's flesh tones look a lot like Rubens' flesh tones, and in fact, they are influenced directly by Titian. Rembrandt was very influenced by Titian's flesh tones. In fact, so much so that Rembrandt names his son Titian. Remember, I had a son named Titian. So Rembrandt. Rembrandt is the bigger name. I'm not sure he's most essentially Dutch sort of artist, but he is he's certainly the bigger name. He painted a number of self-portraits. I don't have time to talk to you about all these, but I just wanted to show you a few in sequence. The wide awake cat, and here one from the middle of his life, and here's one from the end of his life. He painted, I think, 62 of these that we have surviving for today. 62 self-portraits, which seems terribly indulgent, especially if you have a face that is as well, I don't want to be unkind, but I mean, you know, a face like that is not the kind of thing that sells in the art galleries, you know. Why does he paint so often his own self? Well, it's a study, it's an etude. It's a chance for him to think about how the face behaves and how it works and how it is malleable. He paints himself in all sorts of expressions, all sorts of poses, and then applies that to the works where he made most of his money. And that is, of course, group portraiture. His group portraits were his most lucrative industry, pound for pound. In other words, he's sold for so much more than anything else. And there's no doubt that his most famous is this painting. This painting has historically been called the Night Watch. And I want you to know that that's not its title. You're most welcome to use that in this class. It was a sturdy title for hundreds of years in art history. We don't call it that anymore conventionally, but I think it saves you from having to call it its real name, which is the Sortie of Captain Franz Banningcock's Company of the Civic Guard, which is a little bit of a mouthful, and I think the Night Watch will do just fine. The reason why we don't call it the Night Watch anymore is because it probably isn't at night. You may say, well, it sure looks like night to me. Well, you see, there are no torches, for starters. I mean, if it were at night, we'd expect that, if a group were assembling. Moreover, when this has been cleaned and when you can see it in a little bit different lighting, you can see that it's actually daylight breaking through apertures above. This group is assembling in a square and light's falling down on them. But now I've tipped my hat a little bit to the subject matter. I should probably tell you what on earth we're looking at here, which is something that we don't, well, see every day. Although, by the way, the Rijksmuseum has a really funny flash mob where they have actually made this happen in a shopping mall. They have people dress up like this and have a tableau of it. It's pretty funny. It's worth looking at on YouTube if you ever want to do that. The subject matter here is a company of civic guardsmen, kloveniersgolen, as they call them in Dutch. Most cities had, in fact, at least one, sometimes several, companies of civic guardsmen. Imagine volunteer fire department meets homeland security, right? And that's probably a good way of thinking about it, right? These are guys who volunteered to protect the city against Spain in case it actually came down to the worst and Spain shows up. The Spanish army finally show up, then the local civic guardsmen have to come to the aid of the townspeople and so forth. By the time this was painted, frankly, that was not a very likely scenario. It was not all that likely that the Spanish were ever going to come invade Leiden or any of these Dutch cities in 1642 when this was painted. By that point, the 80-year war was all but finished. It was not really a danger. What does that mean for these poor guys who are the sort of the volunteer fire department? Well, it'd be kind of like being a member of the volunteer fire department in a town made of entirely stone buildings, right? Well, let's play some checkers today, right? There's not that much to do. The civic guardsmen then, the kloveniersgolen, were usually depicted eating together, right? It was kind of like the Moose Lodge, like the guys getting together, being guys, talking about stuff, enjoying meals together. Sometimes they were depicted in parades, because they often did that. They would march in parades, they'd get up in their uniforms, they hold their flags and walk along. In other words, it was a place where guys got together and talked about what they might do if they had to really be heroic. And men love that much more than being heroic. We love to talk about, you know, what would happen if somebody broke into my house, or I'll tell you what I'd do, blah, blah, blah. You know, we love that kind of banter. It's really, really fun. And so did they, right? When these officers are depicted, and we have many, many different paintings of civic guardsmen by Halls, by so many others, you know, they're usually depicted idle, right? Eating lobster, drinking wine, enjoying each other's company, that kind of thing. Rembrandt has another idea. He says, what if we were to kind of imagine that they actually had to do something for a change, that we have to have a sortie, they have to be called together to fight? And so he gives us that. He gives us, in an instance, the assemblage of Captain Banningcock's company. The captain himself would have ponied up the money for the painting as well as paid a lot of these individuals to be part of this guard. Right? He's like the big donor. And he's our central figure. Marching out on the field. His ungloved, that is to say, ungauntleted hand leads the way, right? You notice his glove is dangling down over here. His hand reaches out past the normal boundary of the space of the image into our space and falls full into the light, and we see him leading his group forward. And then beside him is second in command, looking in profile right on him. And then around him, an assemblage of all these different civic guardsmen. And our attention is drawn to them in so many different ways, individually, right? Because one of the great challenges of group portraiture is striking a balance between individuation of all the members and some kind of coherent whole. Well, Rembrandt's lucky because he doesn't have to make a terribly coherent whole. His subject matter is a bunch of people kind of falling in on a central town square all at once. Well, that's obviously not going to be visually thoroughly coherent. And nevertheless, he does some things to create a unity here. A lot of these angles of these spears and diagonals and things draw our attention to a kind of continuity within the image. But he certainly does a lot to individuate all. If you were to look at a town square anywhere, let's say, you know, some city block in Manhattan, what you'd be struck by is how anonymous practically everybody is because of the way the vista you've been given is laid out. Rembrandt wants to overcome that. One of the ways he does that is by letting light strategically fall on faces, right? Faces come forward into light and then are exposed, and then we see them sort of molded beautifully before our very eyes, right? Sort of crafted in these great expressions. And the expressions are various. I mean, over here we have our drummer, and he's rat-a-tat-tatting out a tattoo to draw the arms of the people together, right? He's calling them together. This is pockmarked cheeks and deeply sort of sunken eyes, very square set face. Above him, more noble visages conspire about what they're going to do next, right? They gesture to their leader, oh, here he is, and they talk with one another. One thinks of like the conversations in Leonardo's Last Supper, with all the different figures dealing with the news as they may. Another looks out at us from deep within the crowd. Another hunches down behind his fearless leader, gun in hand, ready to fight. Others survey the field, looking off distantly to the Spaniard, even as they raise up a banner to help everybody know where we're assembling. Others still load the gun. And on we go. And in every moment we meet a very clearly crafted face, a very beautifully rendered expression that's very plausible. How can Rembrandt do this? Well, he understands faces. Remember, he painted his own a few times, so he knows what he's doing at this point. Now, many of you will notice something very strange and I think a little bit playful about the image in this girl here. Obviously, the light falls almost incongruously on her. It's from some hidden opening above that falls straight down on her. And the poor girl is caught in the midst of it all, right? I mean, she's caught in the midst of the assembly. I mean, this is only natural. It's only something we'd expect. If a group of guardsmen assemble on a town square, well, we'd only expect that some people would get caught up in the bustle. And this poor girl, and maybe someone behind her as well, has gotten caught up in that bustle. Who is she? Well, she's awfully nicely dressed for this, but it seems apparent that she's a chicken maid, right? That was a common calling in Holland of the period, just as you would have your milk delivered, as you know, I know you will remember milk delivered, I don't think, but it was not that long ago when that was kind of common. So too your poultry was delivered, right? Your chickens were brought along to you, so you have fresh poultry on the day you wanted it. So actually a good way to go farm to fork, I think is the way we talk about it right now, right? We've all had enough of that kind of language, right? There we have a chicken. But in fact, it isn't a chicken. It's a cockerel, right? It's a male of the species. Oh, wait. What's his name? Captain Banning Cock. It's a pun against his name. Captain Banning Cock, right? And his glove is right beside the claws on the chicken in Dutch, kloven. Claws are kloven. Now, what's a civic guardsman called in Dutch? I told you this earlier. I know you didn't write it down, because who could? But kloveniersdolen, right? That's because the butt of a gun is called a kloven. So we have a clove, kloven, clove, kloven in the hands of the kloveniersdolen. Cop, Captain Manning, cop, right? You get the idea? It's fraught with these kind of verbal puns. And for good reason.
The image is apparently playful. I mean, my goodness, we know these guys aren't going to fight. It's not really clear that they could fight. but
we can still pretend. And wouldn't it be fun to pretend, right? And throw some playful things in. In fact, I don't know if you can see this because the shadows really are hampering our ability to enjoy this image this morning. But you can perhaps see in the corner, there's actually a dwarf running off stage as well. He's half armed and he's kind of running out. Another one's here behind Captain Vanning Cock's back, right? So there's kind of these playful events happening all around. There's a dog here in the corner snarling and barking at the drummer. Of course it's fun. Of course it's playful. That's the whole idea, right? It's not an everyday occurrence, but these are everyday men. These are men we know, right? And just as I don't know if any of you belong to a gun club and you have like a group portrait. I mean, everybody, what does that look like? Everybody's sitting there looking tough, you know, holding their, you know, various firearms. You know, everybody snaps a picture. You know, everybody snaps a picture of that, right? I mean, these are like, you know, accountants and, you know, butchers and so forth, and they all look like, you know, army commandos here for like 10 seconds, but nobody believes it. That's the same idea, right? These are civic guardsmen. Come on. But it could happen, right? So this is the fun of the painting. And Rembrandt gives us then something of that Dutch sensibility towards the everyday. But you have to admit that it's also kind of baroque too, right? It's active, it's vibrant, it's a composition that spreads beyond the boundaries, almost manneristic in that respect. It's a composition that's full of lively lines that keep us moving across the surface. It's theatrical. It's just like the baroque, right? So it does meet nicely with the things we'd met at our last meeting, at the same time as I think obviously participant in the Dutch Golden Age as well. So I think Rembrandt sort of meets in the middle somewhere. Any questions about that? Well, I hope this is an encouragement to you to especially as we go into a break, to think about the beauty of the world around us, to attend to it with this kind of faithfulness. And I pray that you will. Hope you have a great break. I'll see you when you get back.